Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Gregory S. Paul, renowned researcher and illustrator. His latest book is The Princeton Field Guide to Mesozoic Sea Reptiles. But tonight, we're going to be talking about an interesting discovery. How many tyrannosaurs are there? How many tyrannosaur species are there? Greg, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you.
Sure, I'm glad to be back.
What the hell happened? It's like, let me see, as a person outside of this, it seems like you and several others, and we'll talk about that in a second, did some interesting research, came to a conclusion, published it, and it was as if you said, you know, like the Pope was a bear. People just sort of had a knee-jerk reaction that that was impossible. Were you expecting that kind of an emotional reaction?
I wasn't entirely certain, but I certainly did run into the Society for the Preservation and Protection of Tyrannosaurus Rex Society.
You got to expand on that, because it wasn't until you mentioned that I realized you're absolutely right.
Yeah, there's just something, you know, there are certain things that are kind of untouchable, and Tyrannosaurus, particularly when it's called T-Rex, Tyrannosaurus Rex, has become so iconic that people just have this kind of automatic reaction that you can't fool with that. You know, and they do acknowledge, yes, in principle, maybe there are multiple species and all this, but they put ridiculously high standards on this thing.
Well, I was going to say, because new species are broken down all the time in paleontology. I mean, that's the big thing, is new species are cropping up constantly.
Yeah, if it had been Giganotosaurus, which is another really giant theropod from South America, if we'd done the same thing, nobody would have cared. It would have made the news somewhat and that sort of thing, but there wouldn't have been this fuss. And I'm working on the third edition of my dinosaur field guide, Princeton Field Guide. And one of the things I've been noticing is that a lot of dinosaurs are named the species with a lot less data than we had. And again, it's no controversy.
Well, let's talk about your research first. Who are the other people that you worked with?
One of them is Scott Pearson's and also Jay Van Ralte. They're down in the Carolinas. And Scott's been working on dinosaurs quite a while, including Tyrannosaurus. And Jay was brought in to help with the statistics. I've been working on this for a long time, actually. I started in 2010. Huh. There was a conference, the annual paleontology conference, Society of Paleontology in Pittsburgh. John Scanello was talking about his work showing triceratops as multiple species over time. And triceratops was the prey of Tyrannosaurus. At the same time, same place. And this is in the upper plains, east of the Rockies, your Montana, Colorado, the Dakotas, in Alberta, Saskatchewan, if I can pronounce that correctly. At the very end of the dinosaur era, when the last of the tyrannosaurs go and triceratops, that's it for dinosaurs. The impact happened and all that stuff. The contrats were emitting all sorts of stuff down in India. So that's the end of that. And John has convinced everybody that there's multiple species of triceratops that evolved over time.
Right.
And I would say, well, that could be happening with tyrannosaurs too. So I told people at the time, well, I'm going to look into this. And it took a long time to get the data accumulated and that sort of thing.
Well, can I stop you there? Because for the benefit of the audience, when you're accumulating data, what actually are you doing? And how many specimens are you looking at?
It's about 36 specimens, which is, reasonably sufficient we're doing here. And again, when other people do even smaller samples of their dinosaurs, people don't freak out about it. So we're looking at a bunch of things at the time, including the robustness of the animals. It's long been noted that there's unusual variation in Tyrannosaurus in the robustness of the elements, particularly the femur, the thigh bone, and that more so than in other dinosaurs. And it's generally been kind of thought, well, maybe this is boys and girls, although there's been disagreement with that. The thing is that if we're all the same through all the strata and there were no change, that could be compatible with just one species over time. Although it could be, even there, you could have two different species, because a lot of this stuff is very hard to determine. Even today, it's very hard to determine species.
Oh, yeah.
In a lot of cases. And also, species, there's no real hard definition for it. It's all murky. But what happened was is that after a while, it became apparent that in low in what we call the TT zone, the Tyrannosaurus Triceratops zone, that the only animals you have for Tyrannosaurus are robust. And then as you get higher, it gets interesting. You don't switch over. We have the robust types and the graciles. As you get higher, you have graciles coming in. You still have robust. And the way it works is Tyrannosaurus rexes are robust, has a certain tooth configuration, as does what we're calling Tyrannosaurus regina at the same time, but that's gracile. And then earlier, the original one is Tyrannosaurus, we call Tyrannosaurus imperator. And the type for that, by the way, is the famous Sioux at the Chicago Museum. And so we have a real pattern here. And again, there are other dinosaurs, and people say, well, you don't have enough characters. There are dinosaur species defined on one character. This is in the literature. Everybody knows this. And again, the statistics are pretty good. But what's also important is we published that paper in Evolutionary Biology, the original paper, back a little over a year ago, about the same time the Russians invaded Ukraine. And then in the summer, I posted on BioArchive, and anybody can go look at it. Just put in my name, Tyrannosaurus, and BioArchives. An extension of this, because it turns out something's really cool, and this is because I was being lazy, and I was looking at a skull of a specimen that, using further data developed after the first paper, realized that this is a Tyrannosaurus rex skull. And I was looking at it, I said, you know, those Tyrannosaurus has these bosses on the post-orbital, behind the orbit and a top, on the top of the skull.
Okay, again, that's a little technical. Just explain for the audience. It's like around the eye.
It's above the eye, yeah. And they're kind of display features. They're not enormous things. They're kind of subtle. But anyway, I was looking at it, I said, that post-orbital boss on this thing looks weird. Where have I seen that before, though? And I realized that Scotty, which is a specimen that Scott Pearson has described, has the same thing. And they're both T-Rex skulls from Hive and the Formation. And I said, wait a second. That doesn't look like the Imperator bosses. And I went and looked. And sure enough, Sue and the other ones down low have a very, very different spindle shape boss. The ones on T-Rex are kind of like discs that project above the skull a little bit.
Is that the one you described as looking like Mickey Mouse?
Just a little bit, yeah. Nobody's illustrated it like that.
So these are bone structures above the eye that there seems to be definite variation in.
Yeah, and nobody really noticed that, and that really sealed the deal. This is classic species stuff. I mean, these are different types of species identification systems that these animals had. So the evidence is overwhelming. And again, we look at other dinosaurs. They're evolving over time, over these same time periods. The time period this occurred was approximately 1.5 million years, from about 1.5 million years before the extinction that we have these deposits laid down to the extinction. The timing is iffy because it's hard to date these sediments, the older sediments. But still, it's about 1.5 million years, plenty of time for species to turn over, evolution to occur, and there's nothing unusual about this. And I'm really not – it's going to become accepted. It's probably – and Scott also, by the way, him and perhaps Jay, they're responsible for doing a third paper, which will look more at the statistics. That's their work. So maybe when that thing comes out – and Scott right now is actually dealing with some of the cool stuff he's got to give him priority on. But when that comes out, that should hopefully settle this.
I want to talk – so there are differences in the skull. Were there also differences in the teeth configuration?
Yeah, the front of the lower jaw, the earlier Tyrannosaurids have a small tooth, have two small teeth at the tip of the lower jaw. Then you get the bigger teeth, the very first incisors. And there's one exception, but that's true for the earlier Tyrannosaurids. And then the early Tyrannosaurs had that same system, with one exception. By the time they get to the top, the second small tooth has become big. Now, there was a paper, and this was a strange thing. Almost immediately, there was a paper trying to refute our paper, which very rarely happens that rapidly. That, again, shows the kind of panic attack people were having. And I'm kind of bugged about it because none of us were asked to review that thing. And if we had, we would have pointed out some things. They did try to make an argument that there was not a homology between this. Now, I'm not going into the technical details about that. But they were missing the point. There is a change. That's what species do. It doesn't matter about these little nitpicking homology things. There was a change. That's what occurs in species.
I think you had 13 characteristics that were different between these three species?
I'm trying to remember what it is now. It was less back then. We've added about six more to the old.
Oh, wow. So that sounds like there's more characteristics. It's more
like maybe about 18, I think.
All right.
But it's still, it's up there. And again, you know, that's actually really unusually good for species identification in the fossil record.
Now, to me, as again, as a person who's just listening outside, you've made a really interesting discovery. And the way that would happen is then other people would test it or look at other specimens and then criticize it in a calm and steady fashion using scientific methods. But it seems like everybody just immediately jumped on it.
Yeah, a lot of people did. And again, it's this people who T-Rex, just the name, has kind of become precious. But also one of the things that was very disturbing about this is one, you know, high-level paleontologist said, we have to make sure we get this one right.
As opposed to everything that's gone on so far.
First of all, they're saying, well, maybe the other stuff we can do is can be sloppy, but we have to get this one right. But also that's not actually how science works. Science often works by pushing edges, and you don't have to be always right. Science is not dogmatic. It changes over time. And this could have been used, as we explained in the supplement of the original paper, this could be as a teaching opportunity. See, Tyrannosaurus rex is not dogma. You don't have to be forced to put all specimens of Tyrannosaurus rex. Science can change, and maybe it can go back. Maybe the future data, actually that won't happen, but future data in principle could show that maybe they are one species, or maybe they're multiple species. And a lot of institutions are missing an opportunity on this to teach the public about how science really works. So that is really unfortunate.
I just get some basic questions about researching speciation in dinosaurs and stuff like that. You can't use DNA, right? DNA comparison, because it doesn't.
No, DNA only goes back.
And people need to, people need to understand. The audience needs to understand why you can't.
Oh, that's because DNA is a very fragile molecule. Why is that? It's because it has to split up all the time.
Yeah, that's right.
To do anything, DNA has to split that molecule.
So the process of going through fossilization is not going to happen.
Fossilization, particularly if it's in cool areas, some of the Arctic stuff, you can go back a few million years, like mammoths and stuff like that. Down in the tropics, it degrades very rapidly. But, that's all you can do is a couple million years.
Now, one of the critics of your paper intensely opposed the fact that you used private specimens for research. Can you explain that? Slowly.
Our data.
Okay. Just explain why that's a problem. I don't understand.
Well, there is a problem. Yeah, and that is that ideally all fossils would go into accredited repositories. For example, one of the major Tyrannosaurus regina specimens, which one is that? Is that Stan? Yeah. Stan was at the Black Hills Institute in the Black Hills of South Dakota. But there was a dispute between the two brothers, so one of them had legal authority to sell it to the Middle East for like $12 million, was it, or something?
Oh, my God.
And it's going to supposedly be a museum there in Dubai or something like that, but even that's kind of sketchy. So that specimen is out of circulation. And ideally, things can go into accredited museums. There are problems with that, though. First of all, sometimes museums burn down or get bombed or looted, stuff like that. So that's not a perfect safety. But also, that specimen, you still can, there are casts of it, there are photographs, so you can still do a lot of work with it. And people often say, well, these private collectors don't do the work right when they're digging them out. But then again, a lot of the old specimens, the work wasn't done properly. The classic Tyrannosaurus mound at the American Museum, we don't know where the quarry level is, partly because that was flooded by the Fort Peck Dam. But still, it wasn't properly documented. A lot of ways. So it would be great if that were true, that everything was done properly, but that's not the way the world is working, and you got to deal with what you got to deal with.
Well, don't other researchers...
You can't analyze the situation properly without those specimens.
But, what are we but the
to
truth
do?
Of the
matter... 100 years to get more of them?
But as you mentioned in your press release, the truth of the matter is other researchers also use, without making a big deal about it, private specimens for their research.
Yeah, and it keeps popping up, and, so this one, Tom Carr, who's the leading critic of what we're doing, he's really big on this business about the specimen should all be public. And again, he's got good points, but I don't think his position is, unfortunately, I don't think is realistic.
Well, it's interesting because I've taught at an art museum here, and art is famous for being bought up by private collectors and then are no longer, you can no longer view it. But there are photographs of those paintings, and you can, it's not like they can't talk about them and not mention them. And now there's increasingly good photographs of this, these paintings or sculptures that are no longer in circulation. And that seems to me, that's the situation here, that yes, there's going to be ones that you can't get in, but there's still ways that you can access data about that specimen, right?
Yeah, and the other issue is that a lot of these specimens, Tom Carr was, I think, trying to get a paper published. I bet you it was rejected. We're saying if these specimens have been put into museums, then we would be all have access to them. The problem is that a lot of people won't allow people on their land to collect specimens if not for money.
That's
the
right.
Specimens
that's
might
right.
Not have ever been dug up, or just the way things work. They would still be in the ground or eroded out by now, and so on and so forth. So,
well, just a digression for a moment. Is that an increasing problem in paleontology? That private, a lot
it's
of these
problem.
Specimens are going into private hands.
Yeah, a lot of people are really ticked off that these transfer specimens go for millions of dollars. So a lot of ranchers will say, and I can't, you know, in a way I can't blame them. If I'm not going to make money off of this, I'm not going to let you on my land. Plus, there are a lot of ranchers who are creationists or conservative Christians, and they won't let paleontologists on.
From a matter of fact, that they don't want you to do your research. But, you know, this is what's happening in the art world, too. You know, and this brings up, you say they should go into museums. Most museums can't afford the prices these things would cost to have, and they may not even have the room to store the specimen. And it's easy to say they should go into museums, but it's such a complicated issue. But in the case of fossils, I think this is really getting disastrous. And you can go on eBay and buy fossils now. Now, a couple of other Carr's criticism, and I just want you to talk about, because the things I wasn't quite clear on. He talked about the problem of taxonomic floaters. What is that? What does that term refer to, and why is that a problem?
Specimens sometimes, even if they have a large collection that potentially belong to more than one taxa, some of them, because of problems with that specimen, you can't figure out what particular taxa they belong into, whether it's a species or a genus. And for Tyrannosaurus, one of the problems we originally had is that there were about three or four skulls we couldn't identify at the time. But using some more skull measurements and also those bosses, we're now down to the only specimen we can identify is the classic New York one. And that's partly because, again, we don't know what stratigraphic level it's from.
Yep.
And partly because it's missing the limb material, which is important. And also, its post-orbital bosses are kind of weird. So, but the rest of them we now can identify. So that problem's been basically taken care of.
Now, Carr also cites 1,850 characters scored in 44 specimens.
That's just bizarre. That really,
wait, wait,
really
okay. First of all, that's what I want to ask you. That sounds like a huge amount of information.
Just go look it up if you want to.
Yeah,
it's publicly available. And what he does is about 100 of those characters are just two specimens, an adult and a juvenile. So that's what he was concentrating on. And a lot of them are just a few specimens. A lot of them are very vague. He was not trying to determine species in that paper. That paper says he's assuming there's just one species for the practical purposes of that paper. So that's completely meaningless. Even when he has a lot of specimens, it's only for, partly because he doesn't use the private specimens, he only has about 10 adults. And again, a lot of the characters are vaguely defined. And for the purposes of what he was doing, that was okay. But to say that, and it's really a bit of a scandal that people just automatically said, well, there are 1,850 characters that Tom Carr looked at, that shows one species. That's totally not true in any shape, form, or fashion.
He also compared femur ratio variation in tyrannosaurs, and I don't get this, to large samples of living birds?
Nobody's ever done that before, as far as I know, where you take a fossil sample and compare it to a living sample like that. That's the comparing fossil apples to living oranges.
In your press release, you said it was paleo apples to extant oranges. I didn't even understand how that's supposed to work. To me, it is apples and oranges. I don't know what you're comparing and why that makes any sense.
Yeah, we're looking at the fossil record, and that's what everybody does. What are the fossil samples telling us? And it shows that, you know, this is an incredible thing. All the tyrannosaurids for about, 10, 15 million years, have a very narrow, the fossils show a very narrow zone of variation in the robustness of the femur, very close to the same line, just on and on and on from juveniles to giant adults like tarbosaurs from Asia, a whole bunch of different species and genera, narrow. And then the first Tyrannosaurus, and interestingly, this is something that Scott found out. I would not have known if he hadn't done the statistics. The very first Tyrannosaurus are on that same line, and they're robust. I thought the first ones would be graciles, but no, they're robust. And it turns out Tyrannosaurs are kind of robust in their femur. Then suddenly, at the very end, while the robust femur Tyrannosaurs continue, you suddenly get this odd population of these graciles. And that's screaming evidence of evolution. Now, there is a possibility of sample size issues, but not really, because the sample size of all the other Tyrannosaurids is greater than that for Tyrannosaurus. So how do you not get this variation initially? And then suddenly, at the very end of the Tyrannosaurid era, with the very last two species of Tyrannosaurus, you get this tremendous variation. That's screamingly telling you something. And what people should have done was, when that paper came out, they should have said, you know what, I'm not really sure about this, but this is really interesting. We're going to have to really look into this.
Right, that's exactly right.
That sort of thing. Yeah. They should have been enthusiastic. They should have said, this is great. Finally, people are looking at this. Instead, they just, reacted like petulant kids, a lot of them. And it was really unfortunate that they did that. And that's not good for the science. And I know a lot of people who are light people who read those, a lot of the articles. Like, we got on, I am quite pleased, we got on the front page of the Science Times and the New York Times on this. A lot of people read that article and said, what's wrong with these people? It's okay. And also another thing about that femur stuff is they may be using animals that were raised in captivity in that sample. I'm not really sure. But if that's true, then the whole thing's blown. You never, ever do that. And they should have either said none of these animals are captive, or if they were, they would have had to exclude those.
Now, we're going to run out of time. The great thing is, and I think a lot of people are probably thinking this, okay, so what's the Tyrannosaurus species that's in Jurassic Park?
Well, this is one of the cool things, and this is what comes out looking at those post orbital bosses.
Yeah.
And it used to be thought that all the Tyrannosaurs look pretty much the same. We now know that the skull, the heads look different. And I have an illustration in the bioarchives thing. It's, let me see here. Go to figure number 11, where I did some three skulls, three heads, showing the differences. And like I said, the earliest Tyrannosaurus imperator, you have these kind of spindle-like things that are very distinct, spindle-like things. In Tyrannosaurus rex, it's these projecting things. In Regina, it's different. We now know what the species look like, and you have to illustrate each one to that species now, which is way cool.
That is way cool.
Now, for the Jurassic Park, that's not any known species.
It's a fourth species. And no, and you came yeah, up, you dubbed it. You dubbed it one of two names.
Yeah, I gave some names. I can't remember what they were.
You did Tyrannosaurus spielbergwinosis or T. Juraparkus.
Yeah.
But that got me to thinking to go back, and I started looking at Tyrannosaurus portrayed in the original King Kong movie and other, Tyrannosaurus are portrayed on all different kinds of films. But that's the important thing is to look. And now when I look at an illustration of like Charles Knight's paintings and drawings of Tyrannosaurs, do those refer to a specific species or are those just generic?
Yeah, I haven't really looked at that. The Tyrannosaurus in the original Kong is based on Knight's work.
That's exactly right.
So that's actually an interesting point. And for the Jurassic Park thing, that's because Winston and Spielberg wanted to copyright the thing and make it look to them more fierce. I did the primary design work for the Jurassic Park Tyrannosaurus, but they changed it. So, and it's very amorphous. It doesn't really have any really kind of distinct orbital display things. So whatever that is, it's not, I'm not even sure it's in the genus Tyrannosaurus, but it's not any known species, and it's not Rex. It is definitely not Tyrannosaurus Rex. We can say that with a high degree of confidence that the Jurassic Park is not Tyrannosaurus, is not T-Rex.
Now, we only got minutes left, and I had one question about your book. Again, it's an amazing book, The Princeton Field Guide to Mesozoic Sea Reptiles. And I forgot to ask you this last time, and I wanted to make sure I squeezed it in. We go through all these ichthyosaurs, plesiosaurs, elasmosaurs, all these great creatures. And then you get to the end of the book, and there's the sea turtles and the crocodilians.
Mm-hmm.
How come they survived and the other ones didn't? Do we have any clue about why that's so? Because I look at the sea turtles that you draw. They look pretty much like the sea turtles we see today. And the crocodilians, actually, a lot of them look like the gharials in India with the long, narrow snouts. But basically, they survived, whereas the other things, like the ichthyosaurs.
The sea snakes did, too. They survived.
Yeah, the sea snakes did, too. That's right.
Yeah, as far as the crocodilians are concerned, the marine crocodilians didn't make it, really. There was one species of semi-marine crocodilian that made it through. But even that wasn't a really highly adapted one. The land crocodilians, or the continental ones, the freshwater ones, did pretty good. As far as the sea turtles are concerned, one thing I don't think I put in the book, I've just been thinking about it. You know, what's one of the favorite foods of a lot of sea turtles?
Jellyfish.
There you go. And what happens when oceans are heavily disrupted? What takes over the oceans?
Jellyfish.
So that
a lot of people don't realize jellyfish are a sign.
Thank you that Yucatan impact for filling oceans with jellyfish we can eat on now. And also they didn't have to worry about mosasaurs chomping down on them and so on and so forth. So maybe that had been a great thing for them.
It's amazing. Most people don't realize that the standard jellyfish are actually a sign of pollution and disruption of the marine habitat.
Yeah.
Wow. I never put two and two together. That actually answers my question. I'm amazed.
It's not necessarily answered. It's a potential answer.
Right. It's a way it's a place to look for further research.
Yeah.
The problem is they don't leave good jellyfish don't leave great fossils at all.
Yeah.
Anyways, we're completely out of time. This has been great. My returning guest tonight is Gregory Paul, renowned researcher and illustrator. His latest book is The Princeton Field Guide to Mesozoic Sea Reptiles, which I recommend strongly. We've been talking about how many species of tyrannosaurs there are and the controversy that it entailed. I want to thank you so much. Thanks so much, Greg, for doing this.
You're more than welcome. It was fun.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name's Mark Lynch. Good night.